Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Back with us this week, Albany County District Attorney David Soares. He's a Democrat, former head of the New York State District Attorneys Association. And David has never been afraid to speak his mind on criminal justice issues. That's why we like to have him on the show. Even if he disagrees, sometimes, maybe, well, we'll let him tell us whether he thinks that's true with his own party. Welcome, David Soares.
How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, since becoming host of this program and having an opportunity to talk to very intelligent, worldly in many aspects, and people who are passionate about what they do is one of the joys of my life. So having you here in the seat today to talk about criminal justice issues, something that's affecting every single community in New York and the nation, is an important thing to be talking about.
Well, you've set the bar very low today if you're looking for inspiration from me.
Not so, because you've been outspoken on the issue of bail reform. You aired your gripes recently with the Albany County Legislature, and you basically shocked them by saying, as a result of Raise the Age, Albany County is the first in the country to adopt an open carry policy of illegal guns for teens. What are we talking about here, David?
Well, we've had and we continue to have violence that I've never seen in my 20 years of practicing here in Albany County. And the vast majority of our violent crimes are being committed by 16 and 17-year-olds who are put through a very different system right now, a system that does not foist upon them any kind of accountability. And what we continue to do is repeatedly arrest the same young people for violent, violent crimes. To give you an idea, half of the crimes that are committed by 16 and 17-year-olds are violent crimes. And then a little over half of those violent crimes are committed with an illegal firearm. And then when you have all of those crimes that are committed with an illegal firearm, one-third of those crimes involve the discharge of that firearm. And when we attempt to hold them accountable by looking to the courts to prosecute them in our court, we lose those cases. We're only successful 7% of the time because of the way that the law is currently structured.
Well, go further with that. How come? How come it would seem like if you've got evidence that someone has used an illegal firearm, that that would be a prosecutable offense,
yeah,
an easy open and close shut case? Why the low percentage?
So let me give you an example. So if Dave Gustina was walking out of his job today and—
Very possible.
And he was carjacked. I'll give you an example that happened here 4 weeks ago where a young lady is carjacked and the young man comes to her, lifts his shirt and displays on his waistband what appears to be a firearm. She's panicked. She screams, and she gets out of the car, and the car is stolen. Well, we apprehend the individual, you know, with a firearm in his possession. And because our witness, right, could not 100% state that it was a firearm, that case stays in family court. So one of the hurdles to overcome is the fact that we have to establish that the person with the firearm actually displayed a firearm, and it is a firearm, or what appears to be a firearm, which when we apprehend individuals in cars, 16 and 17-year-olds with cars with loaded weapons, because they didn't grab that weapon and display it, those are cases that continue to go through family court. So
what happens to those weapons?
Well, we take those weapons, we keep those weapons, we destroy those weapons because they're illegal. But those individuals continue to go through the revolving door of family court, and then they're apprehended in other cases.
With more weapons?
With more weapons. So I'll give you another example. You know, an individual who was apprehended 3 separate occasions with loaded firearms, arrested on a 4th occasion. And in each of these occasions, because they don't display the firearm, there's nothing we can do. It's juice and crackers at family court.
Part of this has to lie outside of this county of Albany, outside the state of New York, right? When it comes to guns and the availability of guns and the illegal guns we see flowing through one of the toughest states in the country to get guns in, New York, we do need the federal government to establish something here, don't we?
We need a combination of things. What we need is the federal government to step in to provide a blanket policies for the rampant availability of firearms. You know, individuals can travel over borders, for example, in Vermont, where it's much easier to acquire a weapon. And then, you know, you're creating a viable marketplace in places like Albany by going across state lines. And quite frankly, we do know where most of our guns are coming from. We call those the iron pipeline. It's usually from southern states, but Vermont also plays an important role in that. So what you do need is federal legislation coupled with sensible legislation here at the state. But what we seem to have right now, David, is a situation where Republicans refuse to actually lay blame on the availability of guns, and Democrats refuse to actually hold accountable the individuals. And it places prosecutors and those of us involved and responsible for public safety in a very tough position. We cannot continue to apprehend young people with illegal firearms and have no means to hold them accountable. By the same token, we cannot continue to exist in an environment where the availability of firearms is as easy as ordering a pair of socks from Amazon.
Ghost guns.
Ghost guns is exactly what I'm talking about, because there are no regulations that prevent an individual from acquiring what is an 80% developed weapon and then, you know, taking the measures to incorporate into that weapon the remaining 20% to make that a viable weapon. That's what a ghost gun is. There are companies that are out there profiting. They know exactly what they're doing. And through mail order, people are able to get weapons.
And your department has been collecting these in Albany County?
Albany County, the Albany Police Department has been doing an exceptional job of engaging in not only gun interdiction strategies, but also executing search warrants where necessary and picking up guns. And over the last 5 years, what we've seen is the steady drip, an increasing drip of ghost guns.
There was a recent column by Chris Churchill of the Times Union talking about why is Albany have more gun-related issues than Schenectady, a neighboring city. Of course, it's Albany, Schenectady, and Troy. They're all suffering gun violence problems. But is Albany more of the direct part of the pipeline that comes up, or is that a real fair dividing line?
So if you look at Albany, historically, we've seen the issue go from city to city. When Albany is experiencing, you know, wonderful public safety outcomes, you will see events take place in Schenectady. And this, it tends to move around because the individuals involved in that lifestyle tend to inhabit all of those communities. But Albany, right now, we are, as a matter of fact, I think, on a trend to continue to see the violence that we're seeing right now, because it's not only the coupling of the availability of weapons, illegal weapons, but it's also the young people that are willing to use those weapons. Then you add a third outlier there, which is the real lack of investment into our youth and sustained, you know, investment. And that that doesn't bode very well. I've been saying for 20 years now, if you want to see what your community is going to look like with respect to violence, see what we're investing in right now with our 10-year-olds, because these are the kids that are going to be growing up in the same environment. And if we're not investing in them, and if we're not taking care of them right now, they're going to be the problem for us in the future.
Speaking of investment, I wondered what your reaction is to Governor Kathy Hochul, along with New York City Mayor Eric Adams and State Attorney General Tish James this week announcing new targeted steps to address the roots of gun violence, they say. Mayor Adams says the $485 million plan, known as a blueprint for community safety, will pour resources into New York City communities and neighborhoods most affected by gun violence. It includes $118.3 million for early intervention efforts prevent young people from turning to gun violence, and over $50 million to improve substandard public housing conditions. At least $68 million would help New Yorkers better access public benefits. Also funds for mental health resources and for improving police-community relations. That's New York City. Now, you and I had a conversation before coming on air about the whole issue of how New York's law used to provide a lot of services that were available for people when they had interaction with law enforcement. to help them going forward. And a lot of those were stripped away in the new law. So yes. Now we come with incentives again here from this latest announcement. What's your reaction?
Oh, I was very pleased to hear about those investments in New York City. Now, there weren't a lot of details with respect to exactly where those dollars are flowing to, but I understand the state has put in $6 million and the other $479 million, I believe, were pre-existing dollars, and I guess they'll be deployed specifically.
$30 million from the state, plus $6 million to help the city beef up its gun violence prevention tax force.
Wonderful. And my hope is that we're going to see some of similar investments here in Albany. No, the problem that we have, and this is a problem that I think exists in every community, is the fact that so much of public safety is foisted upon the shoulders of law enforcement and the criminal justice system. We have a function, to be sure. Our function is to remove from community those people that continue to present a clear and present danger. But there are other functions that need to be had. And what we're seeing happening right now in New York City is it is an example of that. You know, the federal government used to have programs that were titled Weed and Seed, which basically describes what is necessary for every community to flourish. It's law enforcement weeding out the problems and then local government coming in and seeding those same communities in hopes of that, you know, we have wonderful fruit to bear. And what we do not have in communities right now is investment. Part of that is because you have crime that will run out private investment. When you have communities where CVSs are closing, where Rite Aids are closing, where McDonald's are closing or Subways are closing, that's a problem. That is a problem because those businesses can flourish anywhere. But it's crime that drives those businesses out of our communities. So private investment, you're not going to see. Government investment, we need to see more of.
The news that caught my eye this week when I found out I'd be speaking to you on the Capitol Connection, and we are speaking to District Attorney David Soares of Albany County, that Judge Jeffrey Zimmerman blasted New York bail laws. He's on your side, David. He called it a mess. He quoted the Grateful Dead from their song Box of Rain, and he said clearly the bass player and lyricist of the Grateful Dead had never read New York's bail reform statutes. Instead of direction, the statute provides judges with obfuscation and legislative sleight of hand. Now we're talking about judges here, and you've, I know, always advocated for giving the judge discretion.
Look, I don't know why I have to always start conversations with saying that I am a Democrat. As a matter of fact, I am a progressive Democrat.
Would some argue with you on that?
I think they do because I haven't lost my senses. But what we have seen by way of criminal justice reform is nothing short of recklessness. When you remove from the criminal justice system the ability of judges to exercise discretion to even consider dangerousness, that to me is insane. We are in the criminal justice system. We deal with dangerous people, and we apprehend the men and women who go out there, put their lives on the line to apprehend dangerous people, bring them in. Prosecutors can't articulate how dangerous these people are. Judges can't consider it. And the only thing a judge can consider is whether or not this individual will appear next time in court. So we're not taking into consideration the safety of community anymore. What we're doing is taking into consideration whether or not a defendant is going to be punctual. That, to me, is the height of insanity.
You know, we see what many argue is unequal justice under the law because of the way our criminal justice system is organized. So, for example, we'll just use a real simple analogy and I'll get your reaction. Those with the most money win in this game because they can hire the lawyers to weed through the evidence, to find the best arguments. And those with the least end up with the public defenders in a plea deal or worse. And because of that money gap, often the best defense is the best you can buy.
Look, no one is ever going to argue the inequities that exist within the criminal justice system. Those are the same inequities that exist in the medical field. Those are the same inequities that exist in education, everywhere else. It is up to us, right? When I say us, I mean it is up to my generation of criminal justice practitioners to leave the profession in a better way than we found it and to make those steps towards progress. To me, it's a bit of insanity coupled with arrogance to believe that you can just legislate those inequalities away by drafting reforms without the input of people who are primarily responsible for maintaining public safety. And so we have a much more dangerous state right now. Doesn't matter what numbers people are quoting. You know, the fact that New York City will continue to talk about, well, you know, gun crimes are down right now. Yeah, but are they down in the communities of color? Are they down in the very communities that they need to be down? Overall, they may be down, but they're not down where they need to be down. And then this idea that, you know, the reason that we did these reforms is to bring some balance to the system and to deal with the number and volume of people of color in the system. Well, have you considered the black victimization? Like, you literally have placed your thumb on the scale of the criminal justice system, and what you see when you hear about increases in assaults or increases in gun violence, that also means that there's black and brown increases in victimization, because the individuals who are perpetrating these crimes, they're not going outside of their ethnic group. They're not going outside of their community to perpetrate these crimes. They're perpetrating these crimes on their neighbors.
I don't want to get too philosophical about it. You've got to deal with criminal justice issues. But there is something at the heart of this. Why, for example, do we see a lot of gang crime? And you say it's gang on gang a lot of times. It's often not innocent, although there have been innocent bystanders. That happens a lot. But when we see a lot of this gun crime, it's maybe a vendetta against somebody else in another gang. You know, what's at the base of all this?
It's hopelessness. I mean, at the end of the day, it's hopelessness. You know, part of the issue that we have here is the fact that we don't communicate with one another, right? There is a third grade teacher right now in a classroom in, you know, a stone's throw from this building who can tell what's happening in the life of a child, right? They can tell you right now which child is going to thrive, which child is having some issues. So those issues are identified very early on. The interventions that we're talking about need to be incorporated, and they need to be incorporated in a very fluid way so that there's intervention both in the academic setting, but once that kid leaves the school, it's not the city's problem, it's our collective problem, right? So that intervention has to continue all the way home. And then whatever after-school programs that the young person is involved in, those interventions have to be there too. Once we prioritize those interventions, we will see the decreases in crime. Building jails isn't the answer. You know, adding 1,000, you know, more police officers and prosecutors, that's not the answer. We are wise enough, intelligent enough. There's so much data that we have, and we understand what the problems are. But we just don't have the political will to call it out and then to take those steps to incorporate this. Right now, we're living in a moment where we want to blame no one. A terrible parent, we see terrible parents all the time, but we don't want to call out terrible parenting. And so we're going to need courage in order to get through this place that we're in right now. But going back to New York City, seeing those investments, that's a good place to start. But we also need to complement those wise investments with the laws that will enable us to remove and root out those weeds from the community.
We're speaking with David Soares, the district attorney of Albany County. David, technology is flourishing right now. I mean, AI and everything else is moving forward, and there are cameras everywhere. It's kind of funny to me sometimes to read news stories where people are engaging in behavior that they should have known would be caught on some kind of camera. How much is technology aiding you and police agencies these days in finding people and what they're doing and help gathering evidence against them?
The evidence is overwhelming, so it's both a gift and a curse. It's a gift in a sense that we can, in fact, move forward with cases that are purely evidence-based without sometimes the need to call certain witnesses, or even when witnesses do not want to cooperate, we're able to either leverage pleas or proceed to trial with all the technology that's available. The curse is we have to store, you know, the technology. For example, right now we have body cams, we have dash cams, we have city cams, we have, you know, doorbell cams, we have phone cams, right? And the amount of storage that is necessary to, A, download and to keep that material, to turn over that material to the defense, to preserve that material for future appeals, is exorbitant.
Are you doing that, David, or do you have like a deadline date where you have to erase everything?
We are doing that, and we have to maintain that. Now, you know, sometimes you'll hear me complain about other policies that are being considered. And one of the policies this year that the legislature was considering, still is considering, I think the bills are on the governor's desk, is the 440, the endless appeals, even after all the, you know, appeals have been exhausted through the courts, giving defendants the endless opportunities to appeal 20 years from now means that the storage for a case that would have been destroyed, let's say, you know, 10 years from now, would have to remain in perpetuity. So when you're talking about the hundreds of thousands of cases throughout the state with all the technologies, you say, these bills and the people who are proposing these bills should be considering also what that means for local jurisdictions.
They got to print them out first.
Yeah.
We don't have much time, David, just a few minutes now. But I did want to ask you about the scourge of drugs. Now, obviously, criminal justice, police interact with people in the healthcare system all the time. But we're seeing, it's incredible, ketamine, xylazine. It's almost as if people are just trying to find the next higher thing to take. And some communities have been wrecked because of the drug scourge. I assume Albany County is no different.
Albany County is no different. You know, one of the things that occurred here as well with bail reform is the fact that prosecutors, police are no longer able to remand individuals who are traveling from outside of our community. You know, we call 87 the yellow brick road. And if a police officer stops a car with ketamine or amphetamines or anything else like that, you know, those individuals are processed, but then they're let go, which is entirely different. So it's made it more of a challenge for us to leverage cooperation, to be able to move up the distribution chain, to hold accountable the major traffickers. That being said, you know, you have to understand the psychology of individuals who are engaged in this activity, right? With the addiction, because it's always the pursuit of the next bigger high. And there's no rationality there. No one's considering risk. It's the pursuit of that greater high, which is why sometimes law enforcement, my office in particular, we will refrain from like announcing the existence of any new product that is certainly lethal from coming into the community, because if people hear that on the street, that's what they're going to pursue to their detriment.
And it's like an advertisement.
It's almost an advertisement. And so I credit so much of the first responders and the people who are at Albany Med and St. Peter's. These are, we happen to have angels that are walk amongst us, because we get our reports every month as far as the activity reports with Narcan and the number of people that have Narcan, you know, distributed to them is overwhelming, and it's just getting worse.
Narcan is the reversible drug that pulls you out of what could ultimately kill you, an overdose.
Exactly, except it's not as effective when it comes to synthetic products.
Sure.
And what we're seeing right now is more synthetic products hitting our streets.
Not great news. Well, there was big news this week, and as a prosecutor, DA, I think it's worth, since the former president is from New York, asking you about former President Donald Trump, another indictment now, you know, this one for January 6th, the riot, the attack on democracy, trying to stop the certification of Joe Biden's win in the election. And we've seen the slip sliding that he can do on his side, of course, as being a former president, and a seemingly unbelievable ability to continue to gather people who want to support him no matter what he's done.
Well, it speaks to where we are as a country right now, that we can have a former president who was committing crimes out in the open and in plain sight and still be leading in the polls with almost half of the country. My hope here is that Chief Justice Roberts will reconsider the posture that the federal system currently takes with respect to cameras in the courtroom, and allows for camera cameras to be in the courtroom to watch so that America can watch these proceedings. Thus far, I think the only institution that has been able to maintain some degree of confidence, public confidence, has been the judiciary. And I think a lot can be done to restore the faith in our systems by broadcasting these two trials, the two trials being the two federal trials, understanding that there is a state trial to be had, and as well as perhaps, and I know that the indictment in Atlanta is forthcoming.
Well, and I think if you follow what he's done, he really has attacked almost every system that we have in our country, whether it's the healthcare system, the criminal justice system, the governmental system in Washington, the democracy itself. And the idea that you could have so many Americans not trust the very systems that underpin that democracy and put their faith in one person is frightening.
It's so frightening, but I think we set ourselves up for this in the sense that we don't teach civics anymore in schools. And we have a very broad part of our population that themselves are hurting, I think, economically as well as in many other ways. And I think that the conditions are ripe for we saw this happening in Germany, and it's happening here in this country. Not all of us are doing as well as we should be. People feel as though the great American promise has been they've been deprived from it. And when you have an individual that can come in and whose only skill is to divide, he's been a cancer in our democratic system.
He is David Soares, District Attorney of Albany County. He's been our guest this week on the Capital Connection. David, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I know how busy you are. I know the issues you face every single day, and I appreciate your willingness to engage.
These conversations are also necessary. Thank you.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.